first of the third.
Not the overweight boy thing. You can see that there are mics in this passageway here on each side. And Glenn has set those up so that if you have a question you want to ask, if you would, just make your way to one of these mics and identify yourself as, give us your name, where you're from, and ask your question, and then either David or Eddie will be glad to respond to I will say there was a question just asked of me at the break, and the request was that we address this in this session, so I'm going to start there. The question essentially was, are there some genuinely theological heresies that you recognize going around these days that may be landing in some of our churches, and if so, what are they? Is that the question?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. I don't know what David and Eddie would say. I'll tell you, you know, when Paul talked to Timothy about sound doctrine, the word for sound is the word that we get as hygiene, healthy doctrine. And I think it's a matter of being healthy or sick more than it is being accurate or inaccurate. And I can say that I do think there are some unhealthy doctrines going around. I think some of the Calvinistic kinds of ways of thinking are just basically not healthy for people. About decision making or about, I've been given this vision, but I'm going to hold the church hostage to it. Even though it's only appeared to me, I think it's incumbent on the whole church to submit to that vision that I've been given. You know, some things like that that I think ultimately are not healthy for the person or for the church. See what David or anybody will say.
The genuinely theological issues that I have heard lately have related to matters of judgment and what happens eternally. The folks who don't believe that a God who is really good would have a negative judgment. And I've heard that expressed both as a general doubt that there would be, for example, hell, to a little more extreme statement that that the falling on the knee and confessing to Jesus the Lord talked about in Philippians 2 is actually a salvation in them for those who have died. And so everybody goes to heaven. And I've actually heard that from some folks. And that kind of fits in with the tolerant people that say that. Also, just at the University Avenue downtown, and downtown Austin is the epicenter of other things. but we had a situation come up in a cooperative Christian benevolence outreach that we helped with. Some of the folks wanted to add a Muslim component to that, and we actually stood up and said, this is presented as something that is done in the name of Jesus, and we would like to keep it that way. So there's some genuinely theological issues that are out there. And there are others that people have that they would like to be baptized, make them a theological issue or a natural doctrine issue. But there are some.
I think the thing we see on campus more than anything else, particularly young adults, is that the Lord said to me, the Lord told me. And many times this is antithetical to what some of us understand Scripture. And so those are conversations we have going on all the time. Now, God can choose to speak any way God chooses to speak. I'm not trying to quiet the voice of God. But I do think that needs to always be harmonious with Scripture as we look at it and struggle with the means of that. Any other questions here, John?
Yeah. Other questions?
This doesn't sound a little facetious, but not unkind of my stomach announcement. If increasing a sense of urgency and creating anxiety are the elements of successful change, how do you know when you've overachieved?
How do you know what?
When you've overachieved.
Well, I don't know exactly what kind of situation you're speaking from. I'm guessing there's some specific case that you're speaking from. But what I'm talking about is not panicking a church, but rather a leadership, you know, whether it's doing surveys, congregational meetings, focus groups, interviews, that allow credible members of the body to register their level of dissatisfaction with the status quo. I don't think we've erred on the side of overachieving much in terms of letting people give feedback or input. If anything, I think we have suppressed that. And what happens is, if we suppress it, it's eventually going to come out and be much more volatile or explosive. Kind of like a volcano over in Europe, maybe, that's been dormant for a long time because we've made sure it's dormant. I think then there is a matter of, again, self-differentiated, mature leadership responding to the dissatisfaction without reacting and panicking. But I don't know if I'm getting at what you're asking or the context you have in mind.
Let me jump in here a little bit. There has been a tendency in some of my sort of contemporary ministers, some of the guys that are not my age. There was a phase there that I think folks went through where...
You didn't call them the young guys, did you?
Time wounds all heal. But what they... There was a phase that went through where how you were doing as a minister was almost evaluated by how much change you could introduce in the church where you work. So that people would come in and say, well, we've changed the songbook next year, well, now we've got some people with mics singing, well, now we're doing this and that. And so there was almost a sense that change was, by its very nature, change itself was a sign of health.
Or of progress.
Yeah, or progress. And so I think there have been ministers, churches, who became addicted to innovation. And not necessarily innovation directed toward any particular good person, just other folks are doing it, so we're gonna just do that too. And I think a church can yet change by now. It can get tired of the whiplash effect and almost raise the question, wasn't there anything we were doing that was okay?
One thing I've believed and have advocated many times is this thing. this guy, William Bridges, again, said there's a difference between change and transition. Change is making a rather quick or brief shift in some practices, perhaps, but transition is a gradual, internal, emotional adjustment of catching up. And he says that we're in far more transitions than we realize, and that where most people are running what he calls a transition deficit most of the time. I think that's true for churches too, and I caution them, look, don't look for your new minister and select elders at the same time. Don't put a church for yourself through multiple simultaneous transitions. It's not a good thing to do. And it really makes it harder on your people. I think one of the problems with our churches is people that are running a transition deficit because of so many other changes going on in the culture or in their community or in their home lives come to church and say, please don't pull the rug out from under us here. Please just let some things remain stable for a while, because this is our only oasis or only anchor in the white water.
But as we talk about polarities to be managed today, I want us to be really aware that basically 18 to 30-year-olds have stopped being a part of our congregations. You notice this? Mm-hmm. I mean, literature across the nation, my experience across the nation is that for many reasons, 18 to 30-year-olds are not choosing to come in and participate in a lot of our communities. Why? Because they see so much bureaucratic system that they have to work through in order to get into it. Because they see us really locked down doing things without looking at how is the gospel being taken to this culture. And so one of the real sobering things for me, those of us who work on a college campus, we see the kind of the beginning and the just the forefront of much of what's coming to our churches in the coming years. And I would just say to you, we are going to have to just be constantly prayerful about asking, you know, what do we need to keep that's stable and really carry for our people, and what do we need to constantly ask about what is the gospel of the 21st century culture.
I'm John Brown from Sherman, Texas. That last comment kind of spurred me. You know, your first session, David, was about a model where we help people feel that they belong, and bring them to believe, and then we teach them how to behave like Christ. In a context where we have elders of various age groups, various models, maybe characterizing more like hierarchy, you know, how we mostly interact with our church, would you have any practical advice on how to move forward to what you're telling us is the new kind of way that the world's going to respond? Is there something, if you were going to make it almost cerebral, is there a step one, step two? Could you help us with that?
Yeah, let me tell you about a big thing for us as far as the enabling steps. We thought it was really important to be inclusive to the folks in our neighborhood. We live, the congregation is in the neighborhood, the socioeconomic big plan. And so we thought it was really important to invite friends and neighbors to come in from the community. And so on Wednesday night, this is about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, on Wednesday night we said, let's have dinner from 6 to 7, and then we'll invite all our friends and neighbors to come into our worship time. That's what we did. Our folks, members of the Highland Church, started coming, but they found it very difficult to know how to speak poverty to the people. I don't know how to speak poverty. And the before we knew it, our members started saying, well, you know, this food is not really up to the standard of what we usually have on Wednesday night at the restaurant, and it's really hard to know how to talk to these kinds of people. And by that time, we had 350 friends from the neighborhood coming every Wednesday night to our Family Life Center program. So we started talking about how can we invite them into our worship center. I mean, it's like here. Our Family Life Center is there, and the worship center is there, and it's not any further walk from where you have breakfast this morning and lunch and to this place. But we never could get out of our biggest day. Because this environment is so foreign to people in the culture. The illustration I often use, it would be like some of us going into an adult bookstore. It is that big a difference between their world and our world. And so we started talking about downshifting to what are those steps. We started shifting to thinking in terms of front porch ministry. How do we create front porches for people to have conversation, relationship, and so forth, and develop some of this sense of belonging so that they can come in and join us? So what do we do? We've had two church buildings given to us in the last 6 or 8 years because the people meeting in those buildings could not relate to the culture. They got so small that they couldn't maintain the building anymore, so they escaped the home church and said, you do something that we can't figure out what to do with. And so, we've created Grace Fellowship and Freedom Fellowship. There are churches, they don't meet on Sunday morning, they meet on Wednesday night and Saturday evenings for meals and those kind of things. They have become front porch churches. We went into the neighborhood and we simply asked the people, what kind of church do you want to be in this neighborhood? And the people said, we want to be the kind of church that loves God, that does something about the prostitution, does something about the drugs in this neighborhood. We said, how can you be that kind of church? Okay, so all kinds of things are happening now. There's a community garden that's been placed, and so people are coming from all over that community to a community garden. That's a front porch ministry. We don't intend to have Sunday morning worship assemblies at Freedom Fellowship and Grace Fellowship because we want all of those friends and neighbors to come participate with us in our worship time. And that's beginning to happen. We're becoming very inclusive. 5 weeks ago, a young woman came with her newborn. We celebrate new life and recognize all new births. She came with her newborn. She is 15 years of age, not married. We welcomed her and dedicated her child to the Lord and had a big baby shower afterwards because we wanted to belong with her as she becomes a believer and learns how to behave. Does that give some simple steps? And so I think the simple thing is front porch. It's what you've got to do. The question is, maybe, how does the congregation deal with that?
Partly what you're talking about as the church, partly as an elder's hierarchy mark model, how do we change our mindset? You know, there are 8 of us. Some of us are older, some of us are more middle-aged. How do we capture that shared vision to go out into the community and start doing this? I can great examples of what you did to do that, but how do we pull the team together and one of the elders to say, and all of these top rhythm down, you have to change how we think about things because they are going to come sit in the pew with us and we're going to have to get out of where they are. So it's more,
if you're talking
about the generation and just, you know, our eldership and how do they capture a shared vision that their world's changed and we have to go out and do something different.
I guess the short answer is you're going to have to lead by example. The long answer is this is a lot of conversation, a lot of stuff that Charles is talking about bringing about change and encouraging change and not allowing people to hold you hostage. It takes courageous voices to step up and say, this is vision, this is the direction we're going as a faith community. It's not an easy situation. You heard me say it takes years and years and years to get new vision into a church wherever we've been pretty high up before, or however we describe who we've been and what we've been doing.
That's a voice you
do things the same way and be in the same place, and I just don't believe that's true. A lot of the, let's say, the systemic change in groups occurs when a minority of the group changes the way they do some things. And so I'm saying, if one of the generations of the leadership begins to lead in certain ways or reach out in certain ways without making it a power struggle with the others and saying, you ought to do this too, I really believe, without wanting to sound naive, that you can make a difference simply by offering an alternative of how it can be done, how leaders can lead. And I really don't think that, you know, as long as you're not being competitive and subversive and judgmental of those that don't join you, I think you can do that and still maintain their trust and basically extend grace to them and be forbearing, but keep on doing the things you really believe you need to do to make a difference.
I was listening to the several different parts of your question there. As far as becoming a church that is able to, kind of in a comprehensive way, move over and become what David was talking about this morning, that's a big deal. That's a big deal because people have various roles and functions that they've had as an elder, as a church leader. And when you change the form, it sort of changes the way that power is exercised. If somebody likes having that kind of positional power, and all of a sudden they don't have it quite like that anymore, they'll feel like something serious is happening in the church, and especially if it's happening to them. And that would be a little tough. And so there's a place, I think, for sort of loving, subversive activity in the life of the church that they talk about is begin a ministry that has a little bit different structure in the places where you have some influence. Begin treating the people that are supposed to be down from you as being up from you. You probably have a certain number of ministries that you're responsible for in the life of the church. So it can begin in the sector of ministries where you are, as you treat them through an incarnational model. I think it also gives you an opportunity, and I guess my brain on off-ramp here, but gives you a different way of how you picture people who are not yet members of the church, but who are coming close to the church. The church is Nabilene, the church is Temple, some in Austin, I believe, too, who now, if a person starts coming to church and they say, can I be a member of this church? The first question is, have you been baptized? In the language we were talking about, but the answer is yes, you can be a member of this church. And it really follows the pattern of Jesus, that he calls his disciples in Matthew 4. He lets them go out into ministry in chapter 10. He asks them who they think he is in chapter 16. We like to do it the other way. We like to ask them who they think he is, and then we send them to come, and then after a long time, then we send them out. The pacing of the gospel is different. So that some churches have what's called come go with me evangelism. They'll have a Habitat for Humanity house that they're working with. Invite your neighbors. We'll go hammer nails together. We're going to go to the children's home in Quinlan, in Paul's home. We're going to have a work day there. Invite your neighbors. We'll all go together. We work with the name of Jesus. We teach them, don't know his name very well. And that come go with the evangelism. It starts to talk about a little bit different congregation.
foundational culture, and it can happen without any decrees from the top.
I'll add one thing, and we'll move to another question. One of the movies that I use in my Managing Conflict in Churches class is one that's an old classic called 12 Angry Men. It's been redone with different actors, but the redo is not as good as the original that's done in black and white film. It's a story of 12 men that are on a jury and are expected to render a unanimous decision verdict about whether to convict and send to the electric chair an 18-year-old ethnic minority young man. They get into the jury room and they take an initial vote, and the vote is 11 for guilty and 1 for innocent. And Henry Fonda is the one that's voted innocent, not because he's convinced he's innocent, but because he's got a reasonable doubt about whether he's guilty. And the rest of the movie shows how Henry Fonda, because of the way he manages himself and treats other people, and the trust and credibility that he earns within the group, eventually the vote is 12 to nothing in him, or acquitted. And the point is, he was not the foreman, he was just a number. You do not have to be the chair of your group. You don't have to be in the majority of your group to manage yourself in ways that win trust and respect and make a difference within the group. And you can never underestimate the power of living and functioning within the group with high credibility. Okay, what about some other questions?
Most of us have not even looked into, even though what I'm talking about. And that's a tough issue. I'm reading and studying and having a conversation with folks in my world right now.
Well, the conversation about engaging Hispanic culture out of a kind of classic Anglo Church of Christ mentality is tough, mainly because one of the things we have to do is decide in our churches if we want to try to understand the culture of Hispanic Catholicism, not necessarily adopting the religious aspect of the Catholic Church, but there are certain elements in the annual year of Catholic culture that a church might be able to accommodate in some way, or to make the bridge to the culture. You have to figure out what you want to do with Cinco de Mayo. It's a family. You have to figure out what you want to do with the Hispanic bride of the quinceañera. Can somebody have a quinceañera in your church fellowship hall?
We did one.
Okay. So that kind of thing is just part of the culture, and to be able to accommodate culture inside an authentic Christianity is the challenge. And I think it's very, very difficult. But we fail in Anglo churches when we think we don't have a culture. That the other folks have a culture, we don't. That's really dumb. But we have a culture, and we have accommodated the Christian faith in our culture. Actually, we think our culture is the Christian faith. It's just a deep way. But that those kind of thoughts need to be.
We'd love to have a conversation with you, Jeff, because you pray and think about this, because this is really a major priority for us.
I'll say too, Chuck, I've been to some churches that have certainly done better than most of our congregations in this regard, and one of the things David has said, I'm thinking about the North County Church of Christ in Escondido, California. They have a Hispanic staff person, yes, but they have Anglo elders that are bilingual. And they have a Hispanic elder, and they once had an Anglo worship and a Hispanic or Latino worship. The Latino grew so large, they had to switch places and turn the auditorium over to the Hispanic culture, and the Anglos are meeting in the chapel. There are some things about empowering people with leadership and priority instead of keeping them secondary out in the annex that these churches have been able to do, whereas some others have not. They've basically made it a benevolence ministry, is all that it is. But in those that have made some headway, I'm thinking about Southside and Fort Worth as another one. They've done a ministry across the street with women from battered women and their children. They've engaged them in a Bible study. Some elders' wives have actually gotten in on that. They've then been able to invite them into worship and into ministry. But if you look, they've got some Hispanic elders, a Hispanic minister that's very effective, and not just a godfather. And they have some Hispanic deacons. And I'm going to say you're not going to get integration until it's into power and leadership and culture. different degree of focus. Eddie has been given the opportunity to develop some gifts in the area of Bible study, teaching, and proclamation that not every elder has the opportunity to do. But I also believe if a minister has been developed through Lifeline Chaplaincy, for instance, and through experience, it very well could be that the minister is a part of the pastoral ministry in ways that actually are mentoring the elders. I've seen my 20-something-year-old son take somebody that's just been ordained as an elder in his church with him and a veteran elder to the hospital after a severe car wreck. And the new elder was shaking in his boots. But the veteran elder and my son, who had been a hospital chaplain part-time while he was in grad school, basically took him along to let him watch what they did. And they really preferred that he not say a word. Unfortunately, he felt compelled to say something, and then he said, "Wait a minute." But that's what he said afterward. He said, I talked to my sister. Okay. It may be a partnership in which Eddie may teach some people something. One thing he can teach elders, I can show you, from when I was in the hospital in August, he has a go, say no more than 3 minutes rule. And he has different ways of praying. Like one of them, he says, is, you don't have to bow and hold hands, but he can say, kind of like a benediction or a blessing, I'm praying that your strength will be renewed and that these doctors can help to heal your body and that God will give you peace, or something like that, and leave. And that counted with prayer. Well, Eddie might be able to help some elders, whereas you may have some elders that may need to teach the minister. But I think it's a partnership.
It's definitely a partnership, Charlie. And it's also equipping one another. Whenever I am asked to be the individual to speak at a funeral, I always invite one of the staff people to come in with me and have a role in that so that we're sharing in partnership and ministry. So that's an example of going back the other way. Instead of being helping the elder, sometimes the elder can be by the staff. It is a big question. The question, the legitimate question is, elders are going to be involved in pastoring and so forth, what does staff do? And in most congregations, what they have the opportunity to do is to work specifically in marathon ministries. A marathon ministry is a ministry that just goes on and on and on. Youth ministry, children's ministry, all kinds of ministry church. It takes a lot of people to do. If it's a splinting ministry, people get in and get out real quick. That's not the biggest concern about our church. How do we maintain over the long haul so all the business? And most congregations hire staff to do that are very skilled, pastoral skills, teaching skills, many, many other skills. But the key word, what Charlie's saying, what I'm saying here today, this has to be a partnership. As Eddie was talking about elders and ministers, I will tell you one of the things that is grievous in our ministers support team is how adversarial the relationship is between elders and staff. It's not too unusual for me at one of these ministers support network sessions when one of these staff members starts talking about the abusive way he was treated by an elder, for me to apologize on behalf of elders for that unconscionable behavior toward us, that person. I had nothing to do with it, but in the same spirit that Royce Money apologized to African Americans for ACU being segregation people back in the 60s, I think it's appropriate for me to apologize to staff people. And I'm telling you, it's a sobering situation when you hear time after time after time how incredibly adversarial the relationship is between elders and staff. That's one of the reasons we do these, because we're very prayerful, God. We use just some few things we say here to really enhance this partnership that we're talking about.
I also say that I want
talk about this in a little while. Kind of my last thing. But one of the things I think elders need to think about with regard to staff is that the staff that is working with the church ought to help the congregation toward its overall objectives of membership, nurture, and development, formation. That if the staff is there just to make sure that members don't have to grow in certain ways, then the addition and the multiplication of staff becomes,